system. And open a work session on House Bill 2773. This was a bill that Leslie Lewis came to testify that allows elected officials to elect to cease active membership in the public employee retirement system. Representative Brown, I'd take a motion on that bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2723 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Let's move House Bill 2773 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Okay. My colleague did it to me again. Okay.
Is there discussion? No discussion? Okay.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, why don't I comment since I had raised
I'm
sorry to do this, but just put on the record that I'd raised a question about the bill when we had a witness in front of us about it. But on reflection, I was kind of picking at a technical detail that I don't think needs to be of concern. I think this bill works fine for what it was intended to accomplish, and I think we ought to move it as it is.
Okay. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Barker.
Excuse.
Representative Graham.
Aye.
Yes.
Excuse.
Aye.
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 Having received the required number of votes, House Bill 2773 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to carry that bill? Anybody?
Consent calendar?
Do I hear a motion to put it on the consent calendar?
So moved.
Representative Nolan moves that we put House Bill 2773 on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, and because it was a unanimous vote, it's adopted. We'll close the work session on House Bill 2773. And we're not going to work on House Bill 2330 today. We're waiting for amendments from Representative Butler and Nolan are working on amendments to that. If you want to get in on the action on that particular bill, you need to be talking with them about it on the 1039 rule.
Chair, would it be appropriate just to discuss that briefly?
I'll open a work session on House Bill 2330 for the purposes of discussion on House Bill 2330.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2330 was brought as a result of the concerns that we had for very small districts that might even be remote that had folks that would want to be able to return to work because of unique skills and inability to replace those skills perhaps in some areas that those folks would not necessarily be coming forward they would be collecting, but they may not necessarily have other folks to take their places if they were providing. I've got dam tenders and road graders and those folks, those kinds of folks. And Representative Nolan met with me briefly yesterday, and we discussed the possibility of extending that out to other very, very limited circumstances that might affect other than just some of those most rural, because as she called my attention, that there's also small fire districts in some of the larger counties, and particularly where the fire districts may have merged in with other districts and still have PERS employment base. So that's the nature of what it is that we're considering, and I'd appreciate any comments that Representative Nolan may have in that regard.
Thank you, Representative and Mr. Chair. My interest is in using this notion to extend reasonable policy decisions to other districts as well, or other employers as well. That's the nature of what I'm looking at.
Thank you. Anybody else? I know the 1039 issue is fairly controversial. And I know there are varying degrees of opinion on the committee about it. Not going to be an easy issue, but we'll close the work session on House Bill 2330 and issue that's sort of related. We'll open a public hearing on the House Bill 2723, which is it's known as the drop bill. And we'll call Bob Livingston and Tom Chamberlain and thank them for their patience the other night as we had more discussion than we thought we might about successor plans. I don't know why I should have been surprised, but everybody had questions, so we didn't have time to get to this one. So we appreciate you coming back and trying again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston. I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council, and to my right is Tom Chamberlain, who's the president of the Portland Firefighters, as well as an executive board member for the Oregon State Firefighters. What I would like to do is just give you a brief overview of the intent behind House Bill 2723, and I think from a substantive conversation and technical conversation, Mr. Chamberlain would probably be more appropriate to field some of those questions. The intent behind House Bill 2723 is to try to once again deal with, as the chair mentioned, this issue and the controversy surrounding the 1040 rule, and clearly more than maybe even the 1040 rule with respect to this is all of the uncertainty that is in the air amongst the PERS debate that continues to go forward. Basically, what House Bill 2723 does is it provides and allows for a deferred retirement option plan to be implemented through the administration of the PERS folks. I do want to make one clarification, and while I would like to blame LC, and I think Mr. Hendricks wrote this particular bill, I clearly can't. There is in Section 4, one could read the bill to say that under this plan, as it's drafted under the drop plan, a person could essentially start receiving their retirement and then continue with employment for a specified number of years. In 2723, it specifies 4 years. That was clearly not our intent. Our intent behind this bill, and be happy to work with whomever under the direction of if there's movement on this bill to make that correction and clearly make sure that this is not a double-dipping situation where you would have somebody that would enter a drop, continue employment, but yet be receiving a retirement check in the mail. That was not our intent, so I wanted to clarify that because I think there has been a lot of uncertainty surrounding that and a lot of rumors that have been floating in this bill. A little bit more genesis regarding House Bill 2723, I think it is fair to say that this is an attempt to try to deal with, I think, several weeks ago when Representative Vaclin came in with one of his constituents and a concern that they had with all the uncertainty around PERS and another bill. What this one does is this would be more of a broader-based bill that would allow not only those specific to maybe 10% of the population, but allow an option for PERS and similar folks to enter a drop. And one thing I would say before I close my remarks and turn it over to Mr. Chamberlain is that one of the things that we think is appealing about a drop is that not only can they be established to either be neutral, they can actually save employers money. And one of the things that I think is a huge advantage about this particular bill is that those rates that are attached to an employer, it specifically says in the bill that you no longer can charge those, so there's some considerable cost savings to an employer, but at the same time allows them to maintain an experienced employee through these uncertainty of times, and I think that's important to note. The other thing I think that is important to note is also that in the PERS handout that was given to the committee a few days ago, if you look through it, there are some established drop plans. So this is not something that's unique. It would not be something like similar to the bottle bill where we would be stepping out on a limb and doing something that's cutting edge. Drops have been fairly well established, and I think this the information that PERS has provided you even specifies that in that. The second thing I would like to say is that this morning we did have a good conversation, a productive conversation with Representative Vaclin. While I don't want to put words in his mouth, I think he is, or surrounding the issue of the 1040 rule, is intrigued by this element and all the uncertainty that surrounds PERS. So I think that working together with some of the other stakeholders and with the indulgence of the chair, I think that we could have something here that would be potentially a win-win for employers as well as employees. And with that, would turn it over briefly to Mr. Chamberlain, unless you would have questions first, Mr. Chair.
That'd be all right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Chamberlain, and I am president of the Portland Firefighters. Also, for the last 15 years, I've been a trustee of the Portland Fire and Police Disability and Retirement Fund. And I'm not here representing them, but being on the board has given me some experiences with DROP. DROP came about in this country through the public safety retirement systems. And it was an incentive specifically to get police officers to work longer. The system works quite easy. How it works is if you have the minimums for retirement and 50 years of age, 25 years of service, you can activate your DROP. And there's two pieces to it. One is a retirement. The member does not collect the retirement until the end of their drop period. In this bill, that drop period is 4 years. That means that the monthly pension benefit goes into the drop account and cannot be accessed till the end of that 4 years. The member continues working. He can retire or terminate that contract that he has with the employer prior to the 4 years, but they can't work longer than that. Elements of drop include that the member can't work longer than 4 years, that employer contributions stop, the member can't access the money till the end of that time. That's the basic components to drop. So there's cost savings associated with it. Drops have some collateral benefits, such as disability costs tend to go down because you can't be on disability and involved in a drop. It's good for the employer in that you can better gauge when folks are going to enter the drop and terminate that drop. So you have a better handle on when you need to kick up your training costs and things associated with that. In a nutshell, that's a drop. It's pretty basic.
Mr. Chair, if I may add one other thing, too, and this was suggested by one of the people in the work group this morning, is they suggested that with surrounding all the uncertainty around PERS, that maybe something that would at least have the conversation continue forward in the legislative process is that we would not necessarily be opposed to having a sunset on the bill so that people, if they had some angst about it, could get a better sense of what they are and to do it that way. And so while I think that through experience the angst would go away if it would help to at least entertain the conversation regarding this type of piece of legislation, we would also be willing to look at sunsetting something around this. Thank you.
If I could add one more piece. The most mature drop is in Fort Worth, Texas. And they did an evaluation of that drop to see how employees behave while they're in drop. And what they discovered is that drop doesn't necessarily mean that folks work longer. And those that do, on average, only work 2 years longer than they normally would. What they discovered is folks enter the drop sooner, and they don't, and therefore they that's the end result. They work about 2 years longer than they would have.
Any questions, committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I'm kind of a linear thinker, and I'd like to know how this reduces the disability cost. I need to have that kind of lined out for me, how this would reduce disability costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, it reduces disability cost. It's an incentive to be on the drop. And what the end result in the Fort Worth study is that it resulted in disability costs because folks wanted to be in the drop plan and be involved in that and have that benefit. And therefore, it did reduce disability costs. And especially in programs that had high disability, some retirement systems throughout the country, folks don't retire, they go off on disability. And Portland had that type of system. We changed that in 1989, and DROP would have a significant impact on that type of system.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I'm having just a little bit of trouble with that, Tom. So what happens is that they go off on disability. In other words, they become intentionally disabled, or they're more careful so that they don't become disabled, or they are more skilled because if they're in they're at the end of their working career, so they're not as likely to become as disabled. I'm having some real problem with that.
Mr. Chair,
isn't normally an optional kind of a thing.
I understand what you're saying, and what I'm giving you are the results of the study. How that occurred, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, how that occurred, I can't give you specifics. Maybe the people knew that they had to work longer and they became more physically fit. Or perhaps they worked harder to get back to work. I don't have the exact answer. I know what the result of the study was, and that there was a reduction in disability costs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, if I can maybe take a stab at it, and I will do some more research to get you a more accurate answer to this, but one of the things that you need to keep in mind is that only a person that is already eligible to retire can enter a drop. And so I think there are some plans under a drop that if you do have a debilitating injury where you're going to be a long-term disability person, instead of continuing your employment under the drop, you simply at that time cease your employment. And so I think that's one of the things that occurs, but I'm somewhat speculating on that because I'm not an expert on drops, but I will make sure that I get you some information that better handles that question for you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's been my pleasure to work for a number of years with Tom Chamberlain as in my capacity as outside counsel to the Police and Fire Disability and Retirement Fund of the City of Portland, which he's served very ably on the board of for many years. But what I wanted to make sure I understand is the relationship between HB 2723, which most directly relates to the public employee retirement system, and its impact on that and maybe other local government programs. I see there's a reference here in the bill summary to an equal to or better than feature. Does that mean that this bill would require the implementation of a drop plan for PERS, and then because of the equal to or better than provisions of existing Oregon law would then require that the City of Portland system and other local systems would be required to have one in the same nature? Is offered for a response to either one of you?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, that's exactly what that particular section does, is that in drops, as Mr. Chamberlain mentioned, that the kind of the genesis of these came out of public safety, and from a policy standpoint in the past, when there has been something that's affected police and firefighters throughout the state, it's typically been something that from a policy standpoint, we want to make sure that we grab not only those police officers and firefighters that are in Portland, but those other areas where equal to or better does occur. So that's exactly what it does.
Okay. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else? Thank you. Appreciate you coming back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also need to enter the testimony for, we'll just enter Jim Blakeau's April 1st testimony. It's actually from Steve Delaney. Sorry, Jim. You're out this time. You were carbon copied, though. Anyway, it's a question answer on this particular bill. So, members, if you're looking for more specifics, that's there. I think we had to pursue cost information on this particular bill and see if there's any other studies out there. I suspect there probably are. And
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
I think it would be appropriate to hear from the folks in Portland as well. This could be very expensive, it sounds like, for those folks. At some point.
Portland here. Yeah.
If they're going to have further hearings on.
Imagine they'd want to.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Anyone else? Nope, seeing no one else. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2723. And open a public hearing in House Bill 2003. Was anybody here to testify in House Bill 2003? We're going to be getting amendments to House Bill 2003. Anybody who wants amendments, please let the chair know on House Bill 2003. I'm going to have them drafting some amendments. Likely be taking out first board issue, which passed the Senate committee today, and likely the mortality tables, assuming those pass. Any other amendments and interest in that, don't hesitate to let us know or get them drafted. We'll close public hearing in House Bill 2003, open public hearings in House Bill 2008, 2020, and 3169. That's your successor plan bills. And Beth Ann Darby and Pat West are wishing to testify in House Bill 2008.
Greg, do you have your amendments today?
Dave Hendricks is here. I thought I could have him by now, but I don't have.
No amendments available quite yet for detail on 2008, but coming soon.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Beth Ann Darby, and I'm with the Oregon Education Association. And this is Pat West with the Oregon State Firefighters Council. We are looking forward to reviewing Representative McPherson's amendments more closely, but we just wanted to provide a little bit of feedback based on what we heard in the committee on Tuesday. We find his plan to be a very intriguing plan, and we look forward to studying it some more. We do have three areas of concern that jumped out at us when we were listening. On the individual account program, the defined contribution component, on the sheet he handed out, it says that member contribution of 6% of salary, and then it has can be picked up by employers. And this provides the estimate for a 19% replacement ratio for PNF after 25 years of service and a 28% replacement ratio for general service after 30 years of service. I think that I heard him state in his testimony, and Representative, I hope he'll correct me if I'm wrong, that this number is actually a floating number that would be bargained at the local level. We have concerns about that because it doesn't really provide 28% for general service unless it's a 6% contribution, which could leave some of our lowest paid workers with barely 45% of their final average salary, not nearly enough to live off of when they don't make very much money to begin with, and we have rising health care costs and the like. So we have concerns about that component, and we'd like to see that be a 6% floor. The other two areas, we have concerns about the age of retirement as well, suggested in his plan. My members tend to begin their careers much earlier than age 30. His plan calls for age 65 or age 60 with 30 years of service. We just raised the age of retirement in 1996. It hasn't even been 10 years. Currently, it's set at age 60 for Tier 2 members or 30 years of service. We would like to see the retirement age kept where it is. People put in their 30 years of service and they want to go on and do other kinds of activities, we feel that's appropriate. There's lots of things our communities need, and they ought to be able to pursue those issues as well. And then I'll let Pat can speak to the final component because this really hits home for his folks.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Pat West, and I'm here representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And I'd also like to say that the PERS Coalition has not sat down and discussed this plan, so at this time, the PERS Coalition doesn't really have a position on the bill. Again, we're in the same boat where we do find the plan intriguing. Our biggest concerns parallel OEAs with one exception, and that is that disability sticks out very, very strong for us. We have, of course, a very dangerous profession, and disability is a very important component of the retirement system for us. And I use the example, I hate to use myself, but I am a 55-year-old male, and I retired recently. And one of the last fires I went on, excuse me, was a typical house fire, but there was a 5-year-old girl trapped in the house. And I mean, I knew when we got there that the fire was bad enough that I probably wasn't going to be able to save her, but that doesn't stop you. You know, we went in and did a fast attack and did everything we could to get the little girl out, which we did in short order. But the results, unfortunately, were not what we wanted them to be, because the one thing we can't do is turn the clock back. If we don't get notified soon enough, we can't get there in time to do any good. But I can tell you that it took me 2 days to recover, and because of the adrenaline rush, the scenario that I was involved in. And I, at the time, I thought, what if there was one more child? What if I had to go into another bedroom? And I can honestly say that I was spent. I would not have been able to have done that. And I couldn't have said that 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I would have been able to have turned around and gone back in. So the whole point of the job is for us to be able to do it and do it efficiently. And I think that you get to a point in your career where you know that it's time for you to go. There's a couple other things. One is there's many studies out there that discuss, that have dealt with the things that impact firefighters. And I'll use cancer as an example. We have a study that shows that at 25 years of service, firefighters have twice the national average of brain cancer and leukemia. And at 35 years of service, we have 10 times the national average. So the very things that we deal with on a day-to-day basis, the carcinogens and the environment that we're in, actually has almost a squaring effect when you get into the more years of service. And so part of our job is to do the things that we need to for the community, but we also would like to be able to reach retirement and be able to draw some of the benefits that we have earned. So I guess that kind of tied right back into the age, which is in this bill has the age moved up to age 60 and or 55 if you have 25 years of service. And I really would advocate that we keep it at 25 years of service and age 50.
Pat, you're 55. Do you have more than 25 years in?
Yes.
You do?
I had almost 27 when I retired. I retired at 53. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Other questions?
One question.
Representative Richardson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Pat, what is the average age, as far as your experience, for firefighters to begin their career?
Representative Richardson, Chair Knope. It actually is a little higher now, and that's because most departments are hiring. We kind of have a dual function now. It really should be called Public Rescue Department rather than just Fire Department, although we all like the word fire. But because of the EMS training, most of the people that are hired by the fire service are paramedics now, so the age has gone up. It's in the 22 to 25 now for people hiring on.
Thank you very much for your time.
Beth, I had a couple of questions for you. You mentioned some numbers early on, and you said the benefit would be 45%.
I was just looking at Representative McPherson's handout from the other day, and it explains that the defined benefit core would provide, he's costed it out at about 45% of the final average salary, and then the defined contribution component, if 6% is put into it, then it would provide 28% for general service and 19% for PNF.
Okay.
And we would just like to see that 6% a mandatory amount so that our members can see the potential of the 28% or the 19%, rather than have it be a floating number, which is what I heard that he had testified to.
Is that what you said?
Yeah. What I did say is that the proposal is that the core defined benefit plan would be fixed in statute, so that would not vary. No employer would have the right to vary that. But that in order to allow flexibility for individual local government employers, they could change the 6% would be what it would start at with a member contribution at that level, but it could be affected up or down by collective bargaining. And what we're hearing is a preference to have that fixed in statute on the defined contribution side as well as on the defined benefit side. That's what I think I'm hearing.
I don't think that we would object to having it be an amount that, you know, public employees could bargain to have more of their salary, you know, go into that. But in order to make sure that we have public employees who are dependent on their pension and not on our other public systems, we feel that it's prudent to make sure that at least that 6% is going in.
By other public systems,
well,
in what?
In the past, we've had retirees on welfare and collecting food stamps and those sorts of resources.
Well, if they had their base benefit of 45% and they had Social Security, which is probably a minimum of another 25%, that would be 70% of final salary plus, I guess if you even halved, you cut the 28% in half. If you say 28, it would be 98%.
And you're not paying Social Security at that point.
What's that?
You're not paying Social Security at that point.
What?
So that's an automatic 7.53%.
Additional.
So, but if you cut it in half, if you cut the 28% in half and said that, let's say that the employers only put in half of that, you'd have 84% of final average salary.
I think our point is that it needs to be a number that our members can count on receiving. And if it fluctuates up, that, you know, that's appropriate if that's what the committee would like. But we would just like to know what is the base that our members can expect to receive from that component. Otherwise, it's just a supplement.
Anyone else? Thank you. Brian, did you want to testify?
Please.
It appears as though you do.
Thank you. I'll be extremely short. Brian DeLeishman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, FOPO, AOCE, and the Oregon Nurses Association. I apologize for joining the conversation late. I was in a meeting in the governor's office and the Public Safety Memorial Fund, and I assumed that my colleagues had mentioned a couple of points, at least the ones that I had heard. The one point that I didn't hear a discussion, I assumed that they talked about, was the disability portion. And for police officers, that is an extremely important issue. So whether it's a component of this and it's commingled, or whether or not it's a parallel plan, that's a very important component for public safety officers. With that said, I would say it's also very important for nurses and other employees, but I'm hearing very strongly from my public safety folks that the disability portion is a very strong component. And with that, I'll end. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Pearson?
Mr. Chair, just Brian, just to make sure that you had either heard or had understood from reports about my testimony the other day, that it's fully my intention with this proposal that there would be a disability piece, and that the omission of that from this plan, from the retirement plan, does not suggest an intention of not having a solid disability piece available to these workers.
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, I believe I do understand that. My fear is that unless they are linked together somehow in a single piece of legislation, one could pass and the other could not pass. Mm-hmm. And we would be buying one component, assuming the second component was there. And if it's not there, then obviously that causes a major problem for us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else wishing to testify? Jim Green is here. Well.
Chairman, I missed the sign-up sheet down in Senate Education, watching a little bill down there that we have an interest in as well.
Which one is that?
That would be, I believe, it's Senate Bill 761.
761?
761.
Okay. Why don't you talk to my wife afterward? This is the Purse Committee. I'm sorry. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Purse Employer Coalition, which has the Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, the Oregon School Boards Association, and special districts, have also had the ability to take a look at Representative McPherson's plan, and we've handed a letter to him earlier today for him to take a look at, voicing our concerns, and I'll outline that and provide a copy of the letter to the members of the committee later today. While the PERS Coalition of Employees have issues with it, we have issues as well, and you might imagine they're exactly the opposite. And I can outline those for you, and I think it highlights exactly what happened in the negotiations when we were talking about a successor system. The issues you heard from them and the issues you heard from me are the tough issues when you're talking about a successor system. They're what drive the cost of the system, and obviously the groups that we represent are very concerned about the cost of the system, especially the folks that I do. Any dollar that we have to expend additionally on personnel benefits is a dollar that we have to take out of the classroom, and that's becoming very, very important these days when we look at our budgets. One concern that we had with it is that it still requires all current public employers who are in the PERS system to be in the PERS system. We had preferred to have an opt-out provision in there for employers who did not want to be in there. If they chose to opt out, then they would have to have a retirement plan that they would work with their employees on to create. Representative McPherson, and please feel free, Representative, if I misstate or have put your plan in a different light than what it should be, please feel free to correct me. But the second provision, I believe the plan included a cost of living adjustment in it. And when we looked at the numbers that drove the system costs with regard to Representative McPherson's plan, that was one of them. The normal cost rate, I believe, under the plan as it was about 8%, which included the COLA. If you removed the COLA, it got it down to slightly below 7%. So the COLA drove the cost of the system up 1.25, which may not sound like a lot, but system-wide, that's a significant number. While we believe there ought to be something recognizing the ability of purchasing ability for folks who have retired, that COLA, as it currently sits, which is the same one that's in the current system, may be a little bit too much. The disability program, while it's not in the current program, Representative McPherson did testify that he believes there ought to be a disability program and just restated that. And as I've testified before representing this coalition, we believe a retirement system is plain and simple that, a pure retirement system. The disability program that's in the current one has helped drive the cost up to the point of where we're no longer able to afford the system. And while we recognize that on-the-job injuries need to be compensated and those folks no longer can work, we believe that those need to be discussed between employers and employees locally, and that there ought to be an offset with regard to workers' comp and the benefits they may derive from that. Tier 2 in the current system currently has that. There's a disability program, but it is offset against the workers' comp compensation that they would receive. The fourth issue, one that as an association we don't have any longer, but definitely affects the coalition, is with regard to the definition of police and firefighter. We believe that it should be those individuals that are the true police officers and firefighters, and that the folks that have been added over time into the current system are ones that are not necessarily on the line as firefighters and are not necessarily on the line as police officers. Not to say that their jobs are not stressful and they're not tough jobs, but we want to recognize those folks who truly put their lives in harm's way, and those are the folks that police and firefighter and that rate adjustment should be there for. Also, one of the other things that drives the cost of a system when it's a full formula system as this one is not only the ratio and the retirement age, but how you define final average salary. Because you're going to take the years of service times a ratio times the final average salary. And the PERS Employer Coalition has coalesced around an idea that the final average salary should be defined as the base salary over the highest 5 consecutive calendar years of covered service. And we also changed the definition from current of what constitutes when you work for a year. We believe that you ought to have to work 1,040 hours in order to have that count as a calendar year, because currently if you work and you're covered for 1 month, that would count as a year in the current system, is our understanding of how the current system works. And we believe you ought to at least have to work 1,040 is part-time, half-time in a year to have that year count. The individual account program, or the defined contribution part of the plan, there were also some concerns. And actually, on this case, with regard to the employees, we were very similar. The concern is the 6% and the parameters around that. Obviously, we're concerned that it grow and not be above 6% and actually be below 6%, but I think that's up to discussions, obviously. And the pickup, that they may pick it up, we're not sure, and we believe that it may be or could potentially be a mandatory subject of bargaining. That's always been something that we have consistently thought, is adding more things that are mandatory subject of bargaining. And also, I believe Representative McPherson testified that under that plan, when the money goes into the Oregon Investment Council, the member would cover the true full cost of that. And we wanted to be sure that not only did it cover the cost of the administration of PERS, but that it also covered the cost of OIC, because there is some cost associated with the investment and managing of those funds, so that it recognized that all those costs are part of the system. Someone has to pay that. And if they're truly going to cover all that they should be in there as well. And finally, one of the things that we talked about with regard to it is the system that Representative McPherson put on the plan is very similar to the system that was in place in 1953, when the system we currently have in place was put in the books. What we've seen over time are add-ons in there. And and we believe that there needs to be some protection in there with regard to add-ons so that the employers have a voice in saying, are we going to want to pay for those type of things? And that's not to say we wouldn't, but that we need to know what our costs are going to be, and we need to have a say in how that's going to happen. We believe there needs to be some trigger in there for employers to say, yes, we believe those type of add-ons ought to be added into the system, and whether those costs can be sustained over time. Finally, the last two things I'll bring up really contain anything that we see in a successor system, not just related to Representative McPherson's plan. One of the biggest issues we've had to deal with in the current system, and many of you know about it, is over the litigation and a contract right. And we believe that any successor system should contain language that the statutes, the rules, and the administrative procedures or policies of the PERS board or whoever would administer it do not create a contract right for the member, and that it is neither explicit or implied. However, if they do make any contributions as required under most federal law, that's their money. That's not a problem. But we believe that the contract right issue, while we believe there's going to be litigation over it, and we need to have litigation over it and get that issue decided, for systems that go forward, we believe that we don't want that in the system. It has caused great concern and consternation across the state, and also great cost to the point of where we're spending a lot of money on lawyers these days. No offense, Representing McPherson, but we believe there's a little bit better use for that money than paying our lawyers. Mm-hmm. Finally, and I think we agreed at the table with the unions on this, and I believe Representative McPherson said this as well, that this is a separate system. We'd like to see it in its own section of the statute, separate from ORS Chapter 238. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I will provide a copy of the letter to the rest of the members of the committee as well.
Thank you. Questions, Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple, I think, fairly easy ones. One about the contract rights, and what would, if I was to hire on tomorrow as a 20-year-old, what would keep the employer, when I get close to retirement, is saying, we changed our mind, we're not going to have that. You don't get your retirement.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, let me understand the question, that if there was this statute that required employers to be into a system or that they were in the system and there were contributions made, the employer saying, you don't get that now?
We've changed our mind. We're going to have a different plan. We're going to give you a 1% instead of a 2% or a formula or 1.5% or whatever. What I'm saying is, without a contract provision, what would keep some unscrupulous employer from making some radical change later down the line when the employee has based their career based on, I mean, if you promise them 1.5 now, why, and you say you have no contract rights, what would protect that employee for having the 1.5 after 40 years of service?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I believe it's a statutory plan, so I think the protection is going to be the 90 of you folks and your predecessors here making sure that that doesn't occur.
91.
Okay.
If it's a statutory plan and we've participated in it, then those members are going to receive the benefits that are due them up until that point.
Okay, thank you. One follow-up, sort of a different question, though, and this is out of my ignorance on this question. Who else besides true police and fire, what are you talking about there? And with the end of the legislature, which I would certainly agree shouldn't be in that, but who else is getting police and fire?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, I have to be honest on this issue. I represent schools. We don't have individuals in the police and firefighter. We used to, and I would look to one of my colleagues may come up and... they indicate that they can provide the committee with the list of folks that they believe. It's truly not an issue that I'm that familiar with. Portland School District used to have its own police force.
Right.
No longer does. However, some of our education service districts, the teachers in McLaren and Hillcrest, they contract with the Oregon Department of Education to provide those educational services. In those instances, I would say we believe they don't deserve the police and firefighter because they're not the ones on the front line. If something goes wrong, they have duress devices. They call in the OYA correctional officers, and they're the ones that have to deal with those folks. Is there an issue there? Yes. Do I believe they could get injured in that? Yes. That's where they need to talk about a disability plan with their employer on that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Green?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Person.
Mr. Green, thank you for your careful attention to this proposal. It's been a very positive process, both getting the input from the labor people and from the local government employers. With respect to just a couple of the issues that you had raised, the opt-out for employers that you would like to see as part of the successor plan arrangement, would you see that ought to be just a one-time opt-out at the front end of the system, and then once in, an employer remains in? Or do you see a situation you'd like where an employer could, at some point down the road, having participated in this successor plan, could then withdraw from participation?
I'll speak for my own association on that one. I believe that it should be at the beginning. They get the one choice. And the reason I say that, at least for our association, is it would be awfully hard to go in and then out and in and out and have certainty there for your employees and people who you're also trying to bring into the system. There is a different point of view, obviously, from some in some of the public employers across the state. And I would ask that you could hear from some of those folks and they can get you the information on that. At least from our point of view, this is a plan for new hires. And at that point, if it's January, July of 2003 or January of 2004, the public employer should be able to say, no, we don't want to be in that system.
Mm-hmm. Follow up? And is there, do you think, a well-developed understanding among the local government employers that opting out of the successor plan wouldn't affect the financial responsibilities they have to the existing PERS fund for its unfunded liability?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, yes, they do understand that. And I guess part of the concern is it's the devil we're dealing with now. And what we faced here, we're not sure it's not going to be faced again in a similar situation, because part of your plan is a defined benefit. Defined benefit plans, without some sort of cap on cost for employers, only in situations where the market goes bad or goes down can cost employers more over time. And that's the experience we've had. So I can tell you that they're leery of the experience they've had with the system that they don't know about going forward.
Mm-hmm. And then I think there's just one more question, Mr. Chair, if I could. With respect to the definition of police and fire, is the administrative rule that the PERS agency has on who is police and fire, in combination with the statute, and I believe it's the two together that form that the line between who's public safety and who isn't, is codifying that including what's in the administrative rule sufficient, or do you think there are people who are now being treated as police and fire who ought to be carved out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McPherson, again, I'll plead a little bit of ignorance on this one. It's not an issue that I've dealt with a lot. However, with the folks that we have, and I'll talk about the folks that I'm familiar with, and Hasina Squires can talk a little bit about police and fire better than I can, but at least with the folks that I'm familiar with, where we have teachers who are in McLaren and Hillcrest and some of the other OIA facilities, they're teachers. They currently receive the police and firefighter rate for those folks. Our association's position is that they should not be in that definition.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon. The statute, Representative McPherson, is 238.005 is the definitions, and it's sub 16. Thanks. That's disgusting that you know that off the top of your head. wow, that's scary, Jim. Sub 16. Really, there are a number of items, and I really encourage the committee to take a look at what's in here. Really, it could possibly be some serious savings to the state of Oregon. OLCC enforcement agents. I think that's just an example. Jim mentioned the McLaren Hillcrest issue. I just think that from our perspective, we really want to honor those people who are actually providing essential public safety services and who may better qualify for police and fire. I know that the 911 telecommunicators have been trying to get into that definition, and I would Mary Botkin may end up having coronary hearing me say this, but I would submit that those people probably belong in that tier of police and fire more than the OLCC enforcement agents.
And Mr. Representative McPherson, I have to be very careful on this as well. My brother's a police officer. He knows where I live. He has a gun.
No wonder you can cite the statute.
And for those folks, you know, that have truly put their life on the line, our PERS Employer Coalition has said those are folks that do need that additional benefit. They're putting their life on the line to protect Oregonians, and we ought to recognize that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else on 2008? Representative Richardson, do you want to testify on House Bill 2020?
Yes.
I believe Joe Wilson and Joe Schwinnert also wanted to testify on that bill. And while they're coming up, this would have been much more timely had I said it at the time, but we got done with the drop bill. I was going to say, speaking of draft, we're bringing House Bill 2407, the legislator out of PERS bill, back to committee because the chair dropped the governance issue from the amendments, and it doesn't say who the trustees are supposed to be. So we're going to bring that back, put that technical amendment in there, and so you get one last shot to vote on that before we vote on it on the floor. And with that,
Chair, members of the committee, while the handout is being passed out, I'd like to just give a little bit of background. We're here to discuss the Fair Retirement Plan, which is an alternative to the defined benefit, defined contribution hybrid plan that we heard about on Tuesday. And I think a lot of the background for why we're here with this plan was brought forward in what we've heard in the testimony in the last half an hour. Complexity and defined benefit plans have choked our PERS system. And that choking, that strangulation, has caused a tremendous amount of problem and expense under the current PERS system, and what we're trying to do is assure that we don't find ourselves in that same situation again. Fairness is going to be a key in a reasonable replacement retirement plan for new employees. The current idea of using a defined benefit plan is not fair. It assumes that current mortality tables will stay in place. It assumes that there will be an investment return that will be consistent. It assumes that there will be certain rates of pay that can be anticipated. And if any of those assumptions are wrong, it is the employer that has to make up the difference. And that's why it is unfair, because it's so stacked against the employer. And with that in mind, the world of Oregon employers has changed. A couple of the issues that I've already kind of pointed to, one is longevity. In this discussion that we just had with Pat about retiring at age 50, a recent comment made to me by an expert in pensions, he said that of those that are 65 years old, 25% of them will be expected to live to be 100 or older. And so we're entering an era where people are retiring and they may spend half of their life on retirement. And there's a philosophical difference, a philosophical disconnect that's taken place. For instance, one of the comments we heard earlier today was that we want to make sure that we have the 30 now, because after 30 years, people want to go and get on with their life. Well, we're talking about pension plans, not deferred compensation plans. A pension plan is a retirement plan. It's with the idea that there's going to be, you work until you're no longer going to work, and then when you retire, there's going to be enough money there to help you to be able to live your golden years, not do your 25 or do 30, get a what is essentially a deferred compensation check that'll come in as you go and spend the next half of your lifetime working at some other jobs, making additional money. And so what we're looking at today is an amendment to House Bill 2020 that would be a pure defined contribution plan. To give a little bit of background on why this is so important to me, I'd like to just share with you a couple of points from Medford School District as they are looking at the costs that they have to incur. I said that the world for Oregon employers has changed. It's not just longevity, it's also the costs that they have to bear. There are costs such as, in Oregon, the PERS unfunded actuarial liability. In Medford, this is not a huge school district, and yet their PERS costs for 0203,
was $8,243,000. Now, for 0304, it's going up by an additional amount of $1,884,000 to $10,127,000. The Medford School financial officer said that PERS for Medford School District is presently 19.5% and next year will go to 25%. Well, that's on top of payroll and before you deal with health care. Medford School Districts have been averaging at least 14% increase in their health care costs. This next year, it's going to increase by 18 to 19%. And so when you add all of those expenses onto a finite amount of money, then where is it going to come from? And I think Jim Green said it all when he said every dollar that goes to benefit plans that's unneeded is a dollar that doesn't go to the classroom. And so our goal is to help make sure that there is adequate and reasonable and fair retirement plans money, not deferred compensation so that a person can work half of their life, retire, get benefits for the next half of their life, because that is not something that we can financially support. We're heading toward bankruptcy in the Oregon under our current plan, and the goal is to not merely survive, but to reestablish Oregon as a viable place to do business, not just in the public sector, but also the private sector. And so I'm here, Dennis Richardson, not as the representative, but as a citizen of Oregon and a businessman surrounded by representatives of the business community who are here to remind all of us that this capital is one square mile surrounded by the rest of the state, which is a state of reality. And so we have to bring reality to what the decisions are being made here in the capital relating to this expensive and long-term decision that we're about to enter into with a retirement plan. Now, with that in mind, I would like to direct your attention to the Fair Retirement Plan cover sheet. The first couple of paragraphs merely talk about just an introduction. And so I'd like to just draw your attention towards this key features, costs, and benefits, and go through some of these with you. This is so much more simple than what we're having to deal with as we're trying to make these decisions on defined benefit plans. We can't even define the classification of who's going to receive what benefits. We can't decide on whether there should be COLAs and whether or not there should be different types of categories and funding. This is much more simple and much more easy to understand and less likely to be tweaked by future legislators. Eligibility for this pure defined contribution plan, it will apply to all public employees hired after, and we chose the date of July 1st of this year because that's what was decided on in the other alternative, but whether or not that is a realistic date would depend on a whole lot of factors beyond our control. But the idea is that we set a date and we're looking to July 1st of this year. All employees hired in the public sector after that point will be in this plan with a few exceptions. Contributions to the plan will not occur until after 6 months, so that if there's people that come in and it doesn't work out and then they leave, they won't have to be burdened, and neither will the employers. There'll be a mandatory employer participation. Those that are involved in PERS presently will benefit from being involved in this plan in the future. Now, the contribution rates, we're dealing with a pure 401k kind of plan, and it's generous when compared to the private sector. We're looking at a dollar-for-dollar match of up to 6%, and so it gives some responsibility back to the employees to have something to say about their own investment and their own use of income. If they want to invest 6%, there will be a match of 6%. They can have 12% into this defined contribution plan, and if they wanted to put in additional money, then they can do that as well for long-term planning up to the limits that the IRS would provide. That is for the general service. As far as police and fire, we understand that there is concerns about their inability to work as long and also their health, additional health factors that general service employers don't have, and so this is factored out with them being at 7.15%. And so there could be a dollar-for-dollar match up to 7.15%, so they could actually have 14.3% going into their defined contribution plan. Vesting, It's very similar to other, you know, other plans we were talking about. Immediate vesting for the employees portion, whatever they put in, they get if they left a year later. But as far as the employer's portion, that would be on the normal five-year vesting duration. A defined contribution plan like this gives flexibility to younger employees that doesn't exist under a defined benefit plan. You have a young family, and they've worked for 8 or 10 years, and they want to buy a house. They don't have a lot of savings normally, but what they have in their defined contribution plan may be the largest pool of money that they could draw on for a down payment. And so these can be drafted so that they could draw up to 50% of their plan and borrow their own money to use for an important decision such as buying a home. And then there's flexibility. Flexibility at retirement age. And flexibility when a person leaves the plan. Retirement age can be set by the employee. I mean, that may be a little bit too broad of a statement because the IRS has some specific rules that would apply to that, but we can be flexible with that. If they leave the plan, they can take this benefit with them. It's portable. It's transferable. They can roll it over into an IRA or into another retirement plan. It's their money, and they should have that money. And it shouldn't be based only on if they live and work till, you know, for 30 years before it's a reasonable retirement rate. And so they have the ability to be flexible in a time of their lives, especially when they're making a lot of changes and there's a lot of volatility in a person's work career in the first 10 or 15 years. And so this is beneficial for them. It's beneficial also for elderly employees. People are living longer. They are working longer if they have the choice. What we see with this rush to the retirement of this year, where we may have between 7 and 10,000 retirees, and why is that happening? Because they're looking at the maximum benefit that they can receive. With a defined contribution plan such as this, if they want to work longer, that's fine. The longer they work, the more the contributions are being made by them and by the employer, and with the miracle of compounding, the larger their benefit will be. And so they will not be forced to retire at an early age, as we're seeing under defined contribution scenarios. The investment pools will be professionally managed. This is an opportunity for us to have less involvement as a state in managing retirement plans. We have TIA CREF is presently one of the providers for management services for the ORP, alternate plan, and there would be other companies like them that could be chosen from a pool, and they would have different investment objectives and would be able to allow the employee to have some say about what type of retirement investment vehicles will be utilized. The death benefit is more flexible as well. Their account is their own. If there's a premature death, then that the amount of their account will go for their heirs and their beneficiaries. The Fair Retirement Plan provides predictability for employers and flexibility for employees. Now, we anticipate a primary concern, and that is, what about the uncertainty for employees? With the defined benefit plan, you know what you're going to get. If you're unhappy with 45%, but at least it's 45%, right? 45% of what? Well, we don't really know. 45%, assuming that the employer will be able to pay it, and there's not a bankruptcy or something like that, which many large employers are going through in uncertain times. But with this defined contribution plan, we have the benefit of history to give us an indication of what the future is going to be like for those that invest. And so I would draw your attention to the pages that follow the cover sheet. I contacted TIA CREF and said, you've been in business for a long time. You have 2.5 million employees that you're working for across the nation. What if there was a benefit plan that was structured basically like this, where the maximum match was invested, then what would it produce based on history so that we can see, based on what would have happened in the past, what we might reasonably be able to anticipate could happen in the future? And so we used two rates. One was 8%. Why? Because the actuaries have proven to me that 8% for over 40 years may actually be true. And I'll tell you why that is the case. If you turn to the very last page of this pack, and you're going to see a TIA CREF sheet that says rate of returns through 12/31/2002. It says 5-year, 10-year, 20-year, and 30-year. This was passed out to us earlier in our hearings, but as you will notice, if you go to the right column and look down, if someone had been invested with TIA Creft 30 years ago, then they had two basic areas of investment pools. One is pure equities and the other is fixed income. If you look down, if they had invested since 1973, the equities has generated over that 30-year period 9.4%, and the fixed income account is 8.4%. That's in 73. If they had invested in 68, then it's 10.8% and 7.8%. And so we're looking at this, you know, 7 to 11% over time as being a reasonable amount of a rate of return that at least TIA Creft, as one investment manager, has been able to procure. Now, going back to the pages that say defined contribution plan, this is page 2 in the packet, and it assumes a 6% employee contribution, a 6% employer contribution, with an 8% rate of return. Now, take a look at the numbers. If someone started to work at, look at starting age, this in the left-hand column, it says age 25, and they worked for 30 years, then if there has been an 8% rate of return, they will be at 78.8% of their average final 3 years pay replacement. But if they continue to work, say they didn't want to retire at age 55 and they went on and worked to age 62, that 78.8% goes up to 130.7%. It's the miracle of compounding. You know, the further along you are, the greater the pool, the greater the compounding, the higher the return. And if they work, that same person worked to age 65, 162.2%. That is at 8%. The next page talks about that same group of people, the general services people, if it was only a 7% rate of return. And then looking again, if they started at age 25, after 30 years, it's 60.3%. And this does not include Social Security. At age 62, it's 96%. At age 65, it's 117%. Now, the police and fire are in the next two pages. We've increased them to 7.15% contribution match rate. At 7%, a 25-year-old policeman or a police or fire qualified employee after 30 years would have 71.9% of their income. If they continue to work to 62 because they're strong, hardy, and living longer, and have a job where they may not have to run three times back into the house, it's 114.8%. And if it's 65, it's 140%. And then the last page for comparison purposes is police and fire at 8%. If the actuaries for PERS are correct and it is an 8% average over 40 years, then at 25 years beginning employment, after 30 years, it would be almost 94%. At age 62, 156%, and age 65, 193%. Now, I understand that this is based on the assumptions. Everything is based on the assumptions. The defined benefit results are based on assumptions, and this is based on the assumptions that the employees will max out their match. And it's based on the assumption that employees will be employed and stay in the plan for the entire amount of time. We have to change from this attitude that entitlements are guaranteed at any cost. We have to, in our opinion, accept the reality that people have some responsibility for their own decisions. And it is not for us to force employees to be in a plan where they're going to be at a set level of benefits. What we offer here is what has been growing in the private sector since the early 1980s, since 401ks really got started, and what is essentially the predominant retirement plan for this new century, and that is the defined contribution plan. And we offer it as an opportunity for employers to have predictability. There's no unfunded actuarial liability. For employers to be able to provide a fair and reasonable benefit that's for retirement and not for to assume it to be a deferred compensation plan, and for employees, both young and old, to have the benefit of an investment plan that will help them, and they have some control over its investment decision and strategy and portability if they were to leave.
Representative Richardson, is this, are these models before or after Social Security? I mean, before Social Security?
They are before Social Security. They are not
in addition to.
That is correct.
Okay. Jim, you have a model that you guys do that you can do a pension system, and it can show what you get with a system like this, or with a DB for that matter, with Social Security.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we use the Social Security Administration's own benefit estimator to generate that screen.
Could you run that for both the McPherson plan and for this Fair Retirement Plan?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Why don't we have the other two testify, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Chair Canope. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB Oregon. From the beginning, we've been absolutely committed to a defined contribution plan just because we relate to it in the private sector, and we find it so compelling on a number of fronts. The first of which, and a point I've harped on when I've been before you, is the issue of credibility. Like I mentioned, the private sector can relate to defined contribution programs because that is what we have. This program before you, the Fair Retirement Plan, is in fact richer than what you will find mostly in the private sector. For instance, with NFIB, they'll match up to 25% up to 1.5%. Most of my employers match dollar for dollar to 3 to 4%, and so their average payroll costs are in that framework, 3 to 4, 4.5%. I want to tell you, I've got no problem in the world with a richer benefit plan in the public sector, because there probably ought to be some inducement to public sector employment, and if a richer match is what it takes, then that's fine, and I agree with that premise. I think that the defined contribution is compelling because of its simplicity. You will notice a conspicuous absence of variables that can be subject to legislative tweaking or legislative creep, which is exactly what's got us into this mess thus far of escalating costs. I think it's very compelling with regard to affordability. When you are talking about 6 to 7 to 7.15% of payroll, that is absolutely affordable, especially when you compare it to what's going on now, 20 to 25%, which would be absolutely murderous in the private sector. You're talking about predictability and stability, which I think government bears an added burden of having to show that it efficiently manages dollars. That is the trust when you manage public dollars. And I think that this is absolutely consistent with that public trust embedded in efficient management of dollars. And finally, with regard to benefit levels, if you take on the surface the numbers run by TIAA, with regard to pay replacement on a defined contribution plan, I think you'll find that that's more than adequate, and in some cases, absolutely dwarfs the returns that were generated by the PERS system. And so on all these fronts, I view defined contribution as a very compelling and attractive alternative for a replacement plan for PERS, and I hope that it's a model that you adopt. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart from the Associated Oregon Industries. We are the largest noticed business association with 22,000 plus members and represents our employees, about 30% of the private workforce. AOI strongly supports this defined contribution plan as the best and fairest retirement plan for public employees in the future. This contribution plan is also the most cost-effective plan for the public employers. It is important to note that the defined contribution plan is portable. People coming in, people coming out. It is very important to understand that these are the plans of the future. Our members are looking to the future, not just Oregon's retirement plan, but the Oregon itself. It's time to have a plan that's affordable, clearly defined, and easy to work. It's time for the legislature to take control of this and have a plan that works not only for employees, but for employers. The days of the 8% guarantees are over. And I want you to know that we sincerely support this plan and hope you take a serious look at it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Representative McPherson.
Mr. Chair,
I have a series of questions, but I'd first like to start off by saying that it was a great presentation, and one of the reasons I wanted to come and serve in the legislature was to engage in a public policy debate about what's good for Oregon, and I think the kind of the comparison of a couple proposals within this well-designed presentation on a defined contribution option is the best form of debate of public issues. That it's one of the reasons I'm here, so I'm delighted to participate in it. First question is the, and I'll direct these questions to Representative Richardson, although feel free to have turn over questions to others as well. Is the employee contribution element, is that individually elected under this proposal, or is it something that would be fixed in statute, or that employers would decide for their entire workforce? What's contemplated?
The eligibility would be in the plan, but each employee would make that decision with their employer as to what portion of their wages they would like to contribute so that they could have a match of that same amount.
Follow up on that. On
up
that.
To 6% or up to 7.15%.
But I understand the employer contribution is fixed by statute at either 6% for general service employees or 7.15 for police and fire. Is there an employee contribution that the employee individually has the decision to make, and in order to get the employer contribution, they have to put their money in?
Yes.
So it's a true match.
I'm saying this is a true match, dollar for dollar, 1% up to 6%.
And so an individual employee could say, no, I don't want to put my money into the plan, so I'll forego the match the employer would provide me because I'd rather not reduce my pay by either 6% or 7.15%.
That is possible. Each employee would have their own personal ability to choose.
Okay.
Chairman, Representative McPherson, also the employee could take his money and put it somewhere else as a part of a retirement plan somewhere else, have his own retirement plan outside of his workplace.
Right. Okay, can continue?
Yeah.
Okay. Have you analyzed at this point what the impact would be in terms of the extent to which this program, like any defined contribution plan, tends to benefit younger and short service workers as compared to older and longer service workers? That is, this would involve, as compared to the existing PERS system and really any defined benefit final average pay system, a substantial shift of the incidence of benefit, even if the overall cost is the same, from older, longer service workers to younger, shorter service workers. Has that been part of the thinking?
It hasn't been a specific part of the thinking as far as determining utilization, if that's what you're referring to. We do know that, you know, naturally, the older employees seem to make more, and this is based on a percentage, and so they would have higher higher amounts going into their plan, plus the longer that they work, because of compounding, their account would increase, and it is fully portable so that they would be able to take it with them if they were to change employment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can I continue?
Yep.
Have you looked at the analysis that's been done in the field about the extent to which defined contribution amounts, especially within the 401k market, tend to remain as retirement accumulations rather than get drawn down by people mid-career who change jobs and who don't roll over that money into another retirement vehicle?
I have, excuse me, Mr. Chair, you know what, I'm not doing this exactly by Hoyle, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Pearson. We have not spent time on determining an analysis on full utilization versus those that would cash out their plan. But what we do from a philosophical viewpoint is believe that each employee should have the right to make certain decisions in their lives, and we're not going to force them to have a retirement plan that they may not even be able to see or utilize or have any benefit from unless they work a certain number of years. The current defined benefit approach actually is stacked in favor of employers and against employees for those that leave early and may not even realize that there's a benefit. There's a tremendous number of accounts under the PERS system presently of employees who have worked, have gone someplace else, have benefits here, but we've lost complete contact with them, and their benefits will never be received because they were not able to take them with them. They weren't portable. And so, but to answer your question specifically, we have not determined an analytical evaluation on utilization.
Follow up in a similar vein. Have you analyzed what the impact of having participant loans is? I see that's a feature on here. That is, to what extent loans that are taken out from a defined contribution retirement account are repaid so that the money is replenished into the account rather than loans going into default so that, in effect, the worker doesn't really, they get an advance of the retirement money for something they want to spend money on and then wind up without that money there in the account.
There are restrictions on the use of the loans. It's not like they want to go to Vegas and so here's their chance and they want to hit their retirement plan and take out 50%. The restrictions can be built into the plan, and there is an inherent motivation for the employee to pay it back because he's paying back the plan and the interest to his own plan, and so he's essentially paying himself back. And when there is a loan taken out, there are requirements that it has to be paid back within, and I haven't looked at this specifically lately, but I believe it was within 5 years, and there has to be a certain amount of monthly payments that have to be made and has to be based on a promissory note. So it's not like a life insurance policy where you can just pull out the cash values and go do what you want and never have it hurt again. This is a bona fide loan, and there's a responsibility for the employee to pay back.
Oh, if I could, I think I heard that. Although I see in the outline that investments are to be pooled and professionally managed, I heard reference to employee direction. Do you contemplate that there would be individual direction of investments then among vehicles? And is that kind of an element of the question? Does that mean just within pools within the OIC that would have, say, different characteristics, or does it allow people to direct out into the mutual fund market or the private annuity market?
It's a modified control. We would have private administrators who would bid to be involved, and we would like to have the director determine at least four, and maybe the PERS board would decide on more than that number, but we'd like to have competition. There would be four of them, one of which might be TIA Creft. I mean, that's the kind of group we're talking about, but they would have to bid like anyone else. And then they would put forth a series of pools, and the board could determine with the investment administrators what those pools would be, the numbers, and then the employee could choose. Would he want to be in equities? Would he rather be in something that's very conservative? Is he interested in one that is dealing with a balance between different types of investment vehicles? And so the employee would not be going to the Wall Street Journal, putting it on the wall, and throwing darts at individual stocks, but he would be able to look at different pools to decide what kind of risk he's comfortable with, what kind of areas of investment he'd like to go, and then go with that pool of investments that are available for the entire program.
And have you looked at any of the statistical information that's been developed within the 401k market, because it operates essentially the way you're describing, at the relative performance of retirement assets that are managed in that way by participants directing either among a menu of funds or more individually, and what the accumulations are in professionally managed funds where all the decisions on asset allocation and investment choice are made by professionals?
Okay. We presently are having the plan evaluated by two PhD economists, Randy Posdina and John Chandler, John. Excuse me. Oh, Bill. Excuse me. And Bill Connerly. And they want to put together models and answer specific questions. They're working on those. It takes time for them to do that, and hopefully by mid next week we will have accurate information that's more technical than what we've been able to present here today.
Okay. And I think maybe just one more, depending on what the answer is. Are there any other states, and if so, which ones, have gone to a pure defined contribution only as their retirement vehicle for a statewide public employee retirement system?
two presently. One is Michigan, and they went from a more complex plan to a simple plan in the 90s, and the other may I defer for just a moment? There's Massachusetts, is that the second one?
Massachusetts is their governor has proposed.
And is Michigan?
And Michigan has that
one. And the second one is Massachusetts. Okay.
I believe Florida has a choice as well between D.C. and the DB.
There's several that have that. Idaho has kind of a hybrid plan as far as a pure D.C. plan. There's two very visionary states that have worked through this and have come to similar conclusions that we have.
That's all the questions I had, Mr. Chair. And once again, I'd like to compliment Representative Richardson on the quality of his presentation and his responses to my questions.
Well, you more than anyone should know how hard it is to come up with a plan and a presentation.
That's absolutely.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I am a mathematician by training, and you've referred to the miracle of compounding, which concept I certainly understand. The problem I'm having in looking at this proposal is that you have presented a plan that supports in 30 years with 12% of salary and an 8% return to generate a replacement ratio of 76%. And the plan that we heard about earlier, which from Representative McPherson, delivers that same replacement ratio in the same period of time using the same assumption, but at 14%. So my question is, have you run this through Mark Johnson so that we can have apples to apples? I don't see how it's possible that one plan that uses an 8% from employers and a 6% from employees generates almost exactly 76% replacement ratio in 30 years, and you are able to do it somehow with a different miracle of compounding with only 6 and 6.
We're using standard math, and Tuesday they were using new math.
I see.
And so it's different. Actually, the numbers that we have were prepared at my request by TIAA Kreft, and they do this all the time, and they gave me these figures. We would be happy to present to Mr. Johnson specific questions and get his calculations and then determine where the discrepancy is so that we could let you know where that was.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Barker.
There's a couple of things, several things actually. I appreciate, and by the way, I appreciate all the work you did on this. But one of the things that was said was you're showing an 8% compounding over the years, and then I hear the days of 8% are over and done with. They're gone.
Yeah, he was talking about the guarantee. That he was referring back to Tier 1 PERS, the citizens are still reeling from, as is our revenue department.
I'd only differently on that they're reeling from the fact that the 20% and so on was paid out, not 8%, or we'd be okay.
So anyway, that was the difference about the 8%. He's referring to Tier 1 guarantee.
Why wouldn't, if I may...
Follow up.
Why wouldn't the state do just as well as all the private plans as far as using the Oregon Investment Council?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Barker, they might. It's just a question of do we want, when we're designing a new plan, to continue having the state of Oregon be also in the retirement administration business, or would it be an ideal opportunity to go to the private sector where you have companies that make their living doing this, and it's a competitive market, and it's what they do?
A couple other things you said about the 401ks, they've gone to 401ks, private has in the 80s. I would suggest that that's primarily to save the company's money and not so much worrying about what the pension would be. And as a follow-up on that, or a comma, and one of the reasons people are working longer today is because those 401s went into the sink, had to stop and think about that for a second. Had it went into the sink in these last few years, and so people have no retirement. And I mean, I just wonder how you feel about that, the risk there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, it's all a factor of timing and time. These figures that TIAF Kreft developed were as of December 2002. Okay, and so they take into consideration the bubble of the late 90s and the disaster of the last 2 years. When you're investing in your own plan and you're in it for the long term, then over time you're going to be able to have the result of that long-term plan. People that invested in tech stocks and ran their own or did day trading, they paid the price heavily after March of 01. People that were in a long-term investment plan, they may not have as much as they had before, but these numbers were based on those that lived through both the high point and the low point. The 8% actuarial assumed benefit rate that Mr. Johnson has come up with is calculated taking into consideration both the good points and the bad points. Part of the reason we're in the trouble with PERS that we are is because that 8% is supposed to be an average, and yet the PERS board's decision said, no, if it goes above it,
yes,
then that goes to the employees. If it goes below it, well, that the employer has to pay it. That's the heads you win, tails you lose.
Absolutely. And if I may have a
comment.
I'm thinking of a low-income state employee. And so we give them a choice of either putting nothing in or up to 6%. And they're on the borderline, so I would suspect some of them would say, I can't afford this retirement plan that's years down the road, so I'm not going to do it. So then when they come to retire with nothing, then we start supporting them on the Oregon health plan or something. That's my concern. I think we should I'll back up on that. Maybe if we're going to look at this kind of a program, we should just decide and pay a private. We talk about the private sector. Maybe we ought to just pay a private sector salary and not even have a pension plan. Would that be an option, do you think?
Not from my political philosophy.
I mean, that would not be.
Maybe if you could rephrase the question. I'm not clear what you were suggesting.
Should we have a. People are always saying, well, in the private sector they do this. Public sector pay is generally lower. So should we pay private sector wages and then not even have a pension plan?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, that is certainly something that every employee must determine before he makes his decision to come to work in the public sector. I have a son-in-law who's a teacher. He loves teaching, and he loves being off 3.5 months a year. He doesn't make the money that he could make in private practice, but he has chosen to work for those wages in that environment because he truly likes the overall benefit of the lifestyle. He's not doing it merely because he's going to have a good retirement when he leaves. Everyone has a choice. They can choose to work for this employer or for that, and they base that choice on the factors that they're given at the time of the determination where they're going to work. And if they feel that they'd be better off in the private sector, then by all means that's what they should do. And part of that choice is what the public sector is able to pay. Now, because of the problems that we've had in Oregon and a 26-year tail on the current unfunded actuarial liability, that is exacerbated here because part of the money that could go for higher salaries is going to be going to a broken system that we're having to deal with in this committee. And so all of these, there's so many factors, but ultimately it's a decision that an employee has to make as to where he wants to work, and it's going to be based on what is being offered by the employer.
Okay, one more follow-up, with regard to the, thank you, Mr. Chair, with regard to the 20-year tail, or 26, that's not going away, is it? No matter what we do, that tail's there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, the 26-year tail, the best figures we have are based on what the circumstance was as of January 31st of this year, and the answer of your question will be determined to a large extent by what this committee does and what the Senate does and what the governor signs on as far as PERS reform. But in all likelihood, we're looking at a substantial liability. Unfunded liability for a long, long time.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Just one quick
quick item. I just observing the information that Representative Richardson passed out to us, and I thought this TIA craft was a pretty good sized operation, but and looking at the amount of money that they've got under management, we've lost nearly as much money as they're carrying in their accounts right now in our retirement system. So thank you.
Any more questions, comments? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Anyone else out there wishing to testify today? Ozzy Rose. You still employed by COSA?
Yes, sir.
A couple more months, maybe?
3 months.
Huh?
End of July.
Counting it down. You wouldn't be retiring because of me, would you? You can answer truthfully.
Mr. Chairman, Members of the Record, I'm Ozzy Rose at the Confederation of Order School Administrators, and I believe I have to sign a thing that say I'll answer truthfully under the new rules.
I think you do now.
And that's why I'm leaving the business. But I don't get to weigh in very often in this issue because I'm neither fish nor fowl. I work for the people who manage the school districts, but they also manage PERS, so that Employees Coalition won't let me in their group, and the managers won't let, or the employers won't let me in their groups. But I want to say one thing regarding the proposal you just had before. I think it's very important that we do some cost containment. I don't think anybody disagrees with that. I also think it's very important that you wind up with either a defined benefit or a hybrid defined benefit for the public employees. And notwithstanding the previous testimony, the reason you have a defined benefit and a retirement program is to encourage people to stay. I'm not concerned about those who stay a short time and whatever. The idea of human managing your human resources, you're trying to attract people into the system and keep them there. And as noted, the defined benefit does that at the expense of short-termers. And I strongly believe you ought to think about that as you put the package together. And I've mentioned that to you before, and I just wanted to reiterate that.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Rose? Thank you, Ozzy. Anyone else today? I think you'll get more opportunities to testify on both these plans. We're going to put them back on the agenda next week. And hopefully Dave Hendricks will finish up the McPherson
plan. I'm going to walk down there right now and find out where those amendments are. I've been waiting and waiting.
I think Dave's outside. Even if you run right now, you might catch him.
Okay.
Thank you. If there's no one else, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 2008, House Bill 2020, and House Bill 3169. Do we have anything else open? Nope.
No.
And if there's nothing else, committee, we'll look forward to seeing you again next Tuesday. Thank you. Committee.